Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I am your host, Mark Levine, reporting live from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. Got a special double show today. Talk about a couple issues that, frankly, it's hard to focus on so many things that the Trump administration is doing wrong when we've got treason or we have a massive tax scam to steal money from you and give it to everyone else. Well, not so much everyone else, really, just the top 1%. There's so many things going on that this administration is doing wrong that sometimes it's hard to focus on some of the smaller things they're doing wrong. Things like destroying the environment, looting our wilderness, things like ruining our internet. And really, when you think about it, right now, for the first time since these things have been calculated, the top 1% of America owns more wealth than the bottom 90%. So 1% of Americans own more wealth than the poorest 90%. And let's face it, the people who voted for Trump think that's unfair. They think the 1% should own more and the bottom 90% should own less. They are ready to sell their families, give up their freedom, and make sure that all of our natural resources, all of the swamp, it grows until, let's face it, the very rich people have even more power and control even more things. And this is true whether it's the tax scam that we heard about. It's true whether it's the environment. It's true whether it's internet companies. My first guest today, and I have two very special guests. We're going to focus mostly on the environment in the first half hour and mostly on net neutrality in the second half hour. But my first guest is named Adam Fetterman. Adam Fetterman is a reporting fellow with the investigative fund of The Nation Institute. That's, of course, The Nation magazine, which many of you are very familiar with. And what he writes is a very interesting article in The Nation talking how a little-known bureaucrat by the name of James Kaysen is basically reshaping the Department of Interior. You remember, some of you, way back to Ronald Reagan's days, to Jim Watt. He wanted to, I guess, rape the environment and give it all to big companies. Well, let's find out what our government is doing now. Adam Fetterman, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me who James Kaysen is and what he's doing at the Department of Interior.
Right. So, I mean, Kaysen is one of several figures at the department now whose track record goes back quite some time. I mean, he's in a position that is called Associate Deputy Secretary. It's essentially third in command, but it doesn't require Senate confirmation, which is convenient for Mr. Kaysen, because the one time he was up for Senate confirmation in 1989 for a position at the Department of Agriculture, he ultimately had to withdraw his name because his record on the environment was so controversial. So he's an incredibly effective and influential figure who's remained essentially behind the scenes for his entire career in the federal government. But to get to, you know, some of the issues that you were raising
But before we get to what he's doing now, what's interesting, one thing that you mentioned in your article I thought was very interesting by Kaysen, is there's really only one very famous Interior Secretary who's famous for kind of destroying the environment, and that's James Watt under Ronald Reagan. And apparently Kaysen used to work for Watt. Is that right?
He did. He got his start in 1982 working under Watt at the Bureau of Land Management. Of course, Watt's tenure was quite brief, in part because it was so polarizing and controversial. He ultimately resigned. But Kaysen's philosophy and approach to land use, I think, closely aligns with Watt's, although Kaysen is much, flashpoint kind of figure. But Kaysen, not only did he serve under Watt, but he then served under Gail Norton in the George W. Bush administration, And, you know, Watt may have been the most controversial, but Gale Norton certainly comes a close second, I think.
So what is his philosophy? Is it that basically the national parks, the interior, that all this land that under federal land management, that all of it should be given away to private corporations to make a profit? Is that his basic philosophy?
That's at the heart of it. You know, Watt got his start at a place called the Mountain States Legal Foundation, which is a property rights organization. It's still around today, and you know, their raison d'etre, their motivation is to basically defend private property rights. So, of course, that comes into conflict with the federal government, which manages huge portions of public land throughout the Western United States. So,
well, it's interesting when you say private property rights, because most of this property is not private property at all. It's public property, right?
Absolutely. It's public, and, you know, we tend to forget, but not only is the land itself public, but the minerals underneath it are owned by the American taxpayer, and those mineral rights are leased to private companies as part of the Department of Interior's, you know, a multi-use mandate. So it's a key part of what the department does, and it's also something that is designed to ultimately benefit taxpayers. But the department has to do it in a way that protects these landscapes and doesn't destroy some of these cherished national monuments and parks, which have been so much in the news this week.
Yeah, so one of the things that I have trouble understanding is why anyone would want to sort of despoil our environment. I get it, though, if he's paid off. Is this a guy who works for oil or gas or mineral interests? Is this a guy who's being paid either directly or indirectly by these businesses that he's helping take our natural resources?
Well, oddly enough, in Kaysen's case, it doesn't seem to be what's happening. I mean, he has worked in the private sector, but not for the oil and gas industry or on their behalf. He's never worked as a registered lobbyist. He's done consulting work, however, for Washington-based groups and Booz Allen Hamilton. I think that Kaysen is more.
He's a true believer. He just has a philosophy that publicly owned property should be turned over to the private sector for exploitation. That's just, he just firmly believes in that.
I think, yes, I think he does believe that. And, you know, certainly his track record speaks for itself. And you know, throughout his career in government, that's what he's, pushed to achieve. And certainly, that's what we're seeing now in a kind of, magnified way.
Now, the Secretary of the Interior is Ryan Zinke. Is this his philosophy as well? Is this why he's put people like Kaysen in place?
Well, you know, Zinke has a somewhat spotty track record in that, you know, as a congressman, he advocated all kinds of ideas that actually won him the support of conservation groups, including, you know, not transferring federally owned land to the states. But since he's joined the Trump administration, his policies and positions seem to have changed dramatically. And of course, now he is a firm champion of what we're, you know, seeing happen with the reducing in size of monuments and opening up of huge amounts of public land.
Yeah, let's get right to it.
Gas development.
I know about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge that was opened up in the tax bill. Restricting give us some details of the scope of what our government is now doing.
Well, this month, for example, we're seeing oil and gas lease sales throughout the West, hundreds of thousands of acres being auctioned off at rock bottom prices, in part because the price of oil is low now, so there's not a huge amount of competition for this land, and that means that it's just being sold for next to nothing. And a lot of what these companies like to do is to stockpile leases, and then when the price goes up, they can either sell them or develop them. Today,
we have an oil glut right now, right? I mean, there's not only are we hardly importing anything anymore, but there's such a glut on the market, it's keeping prices down. We have more oil than we know what to do with. It's not clear why selling off our national monuments helps us at all right now. Sounds like, as you say, we're selling low at rock bottom prices.
Yeah, and quite frankly, in some of these lease sales, the oil and gas industry itself has not shown much of an interest in acquiring new leases because of the fact that prices are as low as they are. And we're seeing it, of course, with coal, too. You know, there was a lot of noise made about lifting this moratorium on federal coal leasing, and what happened? Well, a lot of coal companies started to withdraw their lease applications because they saw the writing on the wall. So a lot of it's dictated by markets, but you know, that doesn't mean that sensitive areas aren't going to be harmed, or that oil and gas companies are going to go in and try to buy up this land while it's going at a
discounted rate. So we have oil and gas. Rate. Well, what else is taking our public lands? Is that most of it, oil and gas?
Well, there are a lot of, with the monument, shrinking of these monuments, there's been a lot of discussion about grazing rights. So you've got in the West, of course, that's a huge issue and often comes into conflict with federal land management. But I would say that the overwhelming, you know, interest of this administration is serving the oil and gas industry and achieving what they're calling energy dominance. And that just kind of means opening up as much of the public land as they possibly can. I mean, today, for example, the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska, which is not far from the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, is having a major oil and gas lease sale. Something like 10 million acres are up. So a lot of these things are happening and not really making a whole lot of noise. But, you know, the administration is pushing this agenda. And with people like Kaysen at the helm, they're actually, you know, getting a lot of what they want accomplished.
Adam, give our listeners an idea of what we're losing, why it matters. So what if we lose a few million acres in public land? What does it really mean environmentally? What wilderness or what don't we have anymore?
Well, we're seeing it right now with this attempt to shrink, bears' ears by 85%. I mean, it's huge amount of acreage. It's the Bears' Ears National Monument, which is considered sacred land by several, you know, Native American tribes. You've got next week an oil and gas lease sale that will auction off land very close to a place called Dinosaur National Monument, which is in northeastern Utah. I mean, these are some of the jewels in, you know, the American public park ecosystem, and to sacrifice them for what? I mean, is folly.
You said southeastern Utah. I've actually been out there. Is that the area where they have like Red Rock Canyon and these beautiful vistas of these canyons with all these bright colors and all? Is that going away?
Well, not quite so quickly, but it's definitely threatened, you know, and land that had been set aside as part of a long-term management process that was in the works over the last 8 to 10 years has been completely scrapped. It's part of this report that the department released in October identifying, you know, quote-unquote burdens to the energy industry. So they're doing away with all this kind of land use planning that was designed to protect natural resources and allow for responsible development. I mean, let's be honest. The department has never, never frowned on oil and gas development. So that was never going to go away. But they were moving toward a way of doing it that balanced, you know, development with conservation and protecting natural resources. So now we're moving, you know, in the other direction, and it's happening, you know, rapidly and
fair enough.
Much Adam, comment.
We have to take a quick break. When we come back, maybe we'll have some time for phone calls. You can call in 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. And the second half of the hour, we're going over internet neutrality and why you should care. Who controls your internet? We'll be right back right after this.
Rumor has it he quotes the Constitution in his sleep. Is it Super Nerd? No, it's Mark Levin. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275. Got a conservative who casually misquotes the Bible and the Constitution? Send him to school with Mark Levin.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levin. My guest is Adam Fetterman. He's the author of a really interesting article in The Nation called The Plot to Loot America's Wilderness. I highly recommend that you read the entire article because we really don't have time to go over all of it here. It's about how a pretty seemingly low-level bureaucrat, though apparently he's third in charge, named James Kaysen, has basically fired all the Obama-era employees and done what he could to sell off America's wildlife to oil interests, to gas interests, to cut down on our monuments, to really not give a damn about our endangered species or anything like this. I guess my question is, has Congress even noticed this? Has there been some pushback, some hearings? Or is there so much going on in this Trumpian outrage in which we live that this has kind of been under the radar?
There's been pushback from the Natural Resources Committee in the House and the Senate. They've written many letters. I think the reality is that those letters often go unanswered. There are a lot of big questions about how the department has conducted its, you just mentioned the reassignment of dozens of senior executive service employees at the Department of Interior. Questions about how those decisions were made, whether they were politically motivated. One climate scientist has resigned and filed a whistleblower complaint. So questions are being asked. I think what we're all waiting for is whether the investigations into some of these things actually bear any fruit. We won't know that for a couple of months yet.
Now, these are career employees that have been fired, right? Not political appointees.
Well, yeah, and we should be clear that they weren't fired outright.
They were reassigned.
They were reassigned, and some were reassigned in such a way that they took it as a clear signal that this was an attempt to get them to leave, to resign. So I suppose in an indirect way, some have interpreted it as a kind of firing. In the case of Joel Clement, he was a policy advisor and climate scientist. He was reassigned to an office collecting royalties from the fossil fuel industry, which he has no expertise in, and has since resigned. So there are a lot of questions surrounding that event, which Kaysen presided over. And there are also a lot of rumors that there are many more reassignments and changes to come.
This seems to be a theme of the Trump administration, whether it's education or the Interior or recently the Consumer Protection Financial Bureau. Trump seems to appoint people mm-hmm. whose very goal is to destroy the things that everyone working under that person is working so hard for. That's got to be a very difficult thing for someone there. They can remain true to their principles or follow their boss. I'm afraid, Adam, it's very, very limited time, but I did want to give a window into the work you're doing. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And again, everyone, if you want to find out more about the plot to loot America's wilderness, read the article by that name in The Nation magazine. Coming up in the next half hour, the plot to loot the Internet. Isn't that fun, too? Right back after this. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. Moving on to another topic, but actually it's similar in a sense, because we have a Trump administration that is out to do whatever it can to harm consumers and to help big business. Remember, this is what Trump has voted for. They felt that consumers had too much power. They felt that we had too high wages and we needed to be cut, have our taxes increased so we could give more to our superiors in the 1%. Remember, Trumpists believe that beautiful environmental land, it belongs to the oil companies. We need to sell it to them. They also don't believe that we should have power over the Internet, I guess. They think that the businesses that provide the Internet should have complete power over it. All of this comes together in a principle called Internet neutrality. And before you change that dial, before you go away, you need to understand that this boring-sounding principle is actually the backbone of everything we do on the Internet. Just like we can pick up the telephone and call anyone we want. We can even call a competitor of our phone company, and our phone company doesn't cut off our lines, nor does it speed up calls to people who pay them money or slow down calls to people who don't, because that's our phone. We can call anyone we want. We understand that it's as basic as picking up the phone. Well, the Internet right now is the same way. We can go to any website we want. And the only speed that's determined is by the website we go to. We can't say, oh, well, we get there because of Verizon or we get there because of Comcast. And so we should look at only Comcast-approved internet sites. Or we should only get speed to those companies that give Verizon a little something under the table. Again, that's all called internet neutrality. But the Trump-appointed new chair of the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, Ajit Pai, has made it his life's work to destroy internet neutrality, to give away this public good, the internet, which was built up actually by the U.S. government. Actually, it was a defense thing decades ago, and to give it away to private businesses. And to explain why that's happening and what we can do to stop it, I've invited Timothy Carr. Now, Timothy Carr works for Free Press. He's been executive director of Media Channel, written for the New York Times and Time and Australia and a whole bunch of things. But right now, his focus is on preserving internet neutrality. Tim, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So tell me this. What exactly is Ajit Pai, the Trump's chair of the FCC, what's he actually doing and how will it affect the way ordinary Americans use the internet?
Well, he is dismantling a rule that was put in place in 2015 that gives the FCC the authority to prevent internet service providers, again, these companies like Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon, to prevent them from blocking internet users' ability to access other websites and services across the web. I mean, in addition, the net neutrality rules that he's doing away with also prevent them from slowing down access to sites. They may be tempted, for example, to slow down access to competitors' sites or in any other way interfering with our ability to connect and communicate with everyone else who's on the internet.
Now, these companies themselves give kind of contradictory messages when you ask them about net neutrality. They say they don't want to do this. They don't want to slow down the internet. They don't want to violate internet neutrality. They're all for internet freedom. They just want to have the right. It's kind of like a thief saying, I'm not going to steal from you. I just want to have the right to steal from you. Is that what they're saying, or am I missing something?
It's sort of like saying, they're saying, I like net neutrality, but I want to do away with the rule that makes it enforceable, which is sort of like saying, I like free speech, but I don't agree with the First Amendment. And it's kind of disingenuous. But you can also look at they have a very long history of violating net neutrality when no rules are in place.
Tell me something. Give me some examples of that, please.
Well, Comcast blocked access to all file sharing services for a time. AT&T has blocked access to FaceTime and other live video streaming services. Verizon has blocked access to Google Wallet because it was in the process of creating its own online e-commerce system. So there's a pretty ugly history of internet blocking for economic reasons, but there are also examples, and this is something that happened in Canada, but not the United States, but just to give you a sense, there was a Canadian ISP that blocked access to labor websites and blogs because that telecommunications company was in a contentious labor negotiation, and they didn't want anybody to see what the opposition was saying.
So, Tim, I mean, let's deal with some of the arguments that I think, I don't think it's persuasive they want to block a competitor or block political speech. I think we can all agree that's wrong. But some of these large companies say, hey, some people use our services more than others, maybe people on Netflix or maybe people doing file sharing. And we promise we won't harm a competitor, but hey, if you use our internet 24/7 because you're a bandwidth junkie, you should pay more for it. How do you address arguments like that?
Well, that's a scarcity argument, which is to say that internet data doesn't run like water. It doesn't flow like water. It flows like wine. Therefore, it's a scarce commodity for which we need to charge more. But what's happened in the last couple of years is that they've actually have invested in improving their networks, where the sort of congestion that may have occurred in the past doesn't occur that much anymore. Everybody uses the internet to stream videos nowadays. And that is what we expect when we pay for that service. So they do charge different levels depending on what kind of service you want. If you were to call up your internet service provider, they will sell you different tiers of service, different levels of service. You can get a high-speed connection or something that's not as fast and pay a little bit less. What they can't do is block your ability to choose what kind of, in this case, video streaming services you use after you buy that connection. So what they're trying to do
they can is sell, so they can sell you faster speed. They can sell businesses who use a lot of internet more than the individual. That's actually not part of net neutrality. They can do that already.
Yeah, they can do that already, and they already do. You can buy a high speed. If you're lucky, if you're live in a part of the country where the service is offered, you can buy a fiber connection, and you pay more than that were you to use cable or satellite if you have those choices as well. Okay, even the companies themselves offer different levels of service depending on your usage. And so that's fine. I'm happy to pay for whatever level, you know, is appropriate for the amount of data that I use. But once I strike that contract with Comcast or AT&T and Verizon, I want them to get out of my way so that I can then connect with whomever I choose.
So now, what is Chairman Pai specifically threatening to do? When he ends it, is it just going to end net neutrality tomorrow, or have they ended already? Or give me an idea of the time frame here. And I understand something's coming up before Congress in a week.
Well, it's actually not. It's a vote at the FCC on December 14th, which is Thursday.
Oh, FCC. Okay, not Congress.
And so, you know, Congress makes the laws. They write telecommunications policy, and then it's the job of the FCC to interpret them. And that interpretation can become pretty drastic based on the politics of who's in the majority at the FCC. This is a very dramatic effort to rewrite Obama-era net neutrality rules. I'm sorry, rewrite is not the right word. They're not rewriting anything.
Abolish, I guess.
They're completely devastating the rules. They're getting rid of them altogether, and they have no plans whatsoever to replace them.
So next Thursday, a week from tomorrow, the FCC is going to dramatically end net neutrality if Ajit Pai and his group gets their way. I mean, that's their goal. In order to let Verizon, Comcast, whomever, discriminate, based on and say, oh, you can go there, but you can't go there on the internet. I mean, that's the plan a week from tomorrow.
Yes, and essentially this is all about who gets control over the future of communications. And as we do more things via high-speed internet connections, the large phone and cable companies want to take away our ability to choose. So this is effectively handing the future of communications to these handful of powerful companies. Verizon, one of which Verizon Ajit Pai used to work for. So this is a massive giveaway, and it's a giveaway of our rights to access a democratic media system.
Got it. Tim, I'm going to take a quick break. In the meantime, folks, get your pens ready, because when we come back, I'm going to ask Tim exactly how you can contact the FCC and weigh in on what you think should be done. After all, if they hear from 100 companies and a million American citizens, maybe we can persuade them to change their mind. 888-48-MARK, 888-48-6275, right back after.
Schooling the GOP, one hand tied behind his back, the Constitution in the other. It's Mark Levin. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275. Who says nerds can't be fun? It's Mark Levin.
You might remember on last week's episode, we talked about the FCC's plan to undermine net neutrality regulations by stripping internet service providers of their current Title II classification. And at the end of our piece, we asked you to reach out to the FCC, and we even set up this website to make it easier to leave a comment. And frankly, comment you did.
Go FCC yourself is trending on Twitter this morning.
This comes after last night's John Oliver from the Last Week Tonight asked all of his viewers to flood the Federal Communications Commission to save net neutrality again.
Come on! Everything about that man's tone is hugely insulting. And let me explain particularly why. What he's essentially saying there is, John Oliver, a comedian you think about so little, you probably didn't even notice, that is not John Oliver, that's Stephen Colbert. Come
So good work, John Oliver. I mean, it's hard to make comedy out of the FCC's threat to abolish net neutrality, but go FCC yourself is a way to leave comments. And after all, the big decision will be made a week from tomorrow. My guest is Timothy Carr. He is with the Free Press, and he's been warning us about this. Timothy, do websites like Go FCC Yourself, do they work and do they help?
Well, sure. That's one effort that was very effective in pushing comments to the FCC. So effective, it reportedly crashed the FCC's own comment website after he first aired that program. There are other efforts to get comments at the FCC. We are part of one called BattleForTheNet.com, which has been very effective. And in fact, since Pi announced his plan to dismantle net neutrality. Less than 2 weeks ago, we've pushed 750,000 phone calls to Congress.
Wow!
And so, you know, Congress is hearing about this, and they're hearing
750,000 phone calls, and probably millions of comments.
From Republicans and Democrats, we have polling that shows that, you know, you get outside of the Washington Beltway, and it doesn't matter whether you're left or right, you support net neutrality.
By the way, when I saw John Oliver's program, I also personally left a comment at Go FCC Yourself. And I encourage people to do so. It's really easy to do, and you can say whatever you want. Do we know, Timothy, how many total comments they've gotten?
Yeah, they've broken all records. There are more than 22 million comments.
22 million comments, and I suspect at least 21 million of those oppose the decision to end net neutrality.
They do. A large majority of original comments oppose.
I was probably one of those.
Oppose the effort to destroy net neutrality. There's been tampering with the comment engine. There are some faked comments in there that we're concerned about, but
faked comments in support or in opposition?
What's that?
Faked comments on whose side?
There are 1.4 million fake comments that support Chairman Pai's efforts to destroy net neutrality.
So 1.4 million.
We've contacted a lot of the people who made those comments, and they said. They didn't make those comments. It's somebody just got their email address and stuffed the ballot.
Wow. So even the very few that do support it all appear to be fake. Is there going to be any congressional hearing on this, or do we just have to keep annoying the FCC as much as possible?
There have been a number of congressional hearings, and then and because there have been so many calls to Congress, your members of Congress know that tampering with net neutrality is a political third rail. There will likely be efforts in Congress to write new legislation. We don't have a lot of confidence that this Congress will do the right thing. They are under the thrall of the phone and cable lobby, which spends millions and millions of dollars on campaign contributions and lobbyists. So we don't have a lot of faith, unfortunately, that our elected representatives will actually represent us.
Let me quickly go to the phones. We've got line 4, Reggie from Georgia. Hey, Reggie, how are you?
How you doing, guys? Well, first they came, saw, took over Congress, and now practically own talk radio. Then they did the exact same thing to network and cable television, or TV, rather. Now they're trying to do the exact same thing to the Internet with trying to stop or destroy net neutrality possibly forever. What can we do about this? How can we stop them from doing that to make sure that the Internet remains as it once is, as it is now, free?
Well, thanks for your call, Reggie. I appreciate that. We mentioned leaving FCC comments, calling members of Congress. Are those the two most effective ways to do things, Timothy, or are there other things we can do?
Those have been very effective, and we have to continue to remain hopeful and vigilant. And once this vote goes down on December 14th, and we fully expect that the Republican majority there will take away our net neutrality rights, Free Press plans to take the FCC to court. There are other congressional procedures, including resolutions of disapproval that will be asking people to support. I mean, the December 14th is not will not be the final word on net neutrality, but you can go to freepress.net, which is my website, our organization's website, and we have a lot of resources there for people who want to do more.
Okay, let's go quickly to line 3, Michael from the Bronx, Old Faithful. How are you, Michael?
Hello, gentlemen. Another thing to take note of. It's the double standards that's going on. Why there's supposed to be civility in, let's say, Facebook or these other internet social media areas. You notice that the people on our opposition on the ones that are inciting the violence and riots through their rhetoric, but then they're given a free pass. But when we call them out on it, then all of a sudden we're race baiting, or we're trying to start something, try to start some kind of problem, and we're the ones getting reported on an absolute false accusation.
Got it.
Something to keep aware of.
Thanks for your call, Michael. One of the things I want to ask Timothy before we leave is just how much swamp is there? In other words, how much do telecommunications companies give to members of Congress, specifically on this issue of dismantling net neutrality? I mean, how much are we talking about here?
It's massive, and you know, companies like AT&T and Verizon have been most active in terms of campaign contributions on any issue, but they have really focused their efforts on dismantling net neutrality over the last 10 years. And we're talking to the magnitude of tens of millions of dollars in campaign contributions, but that's not all. They also spend millions of dollars more on lobbying firms and lawyers, PR firms to create ads, to create what we call AstroTurf, these websites that claim to represent the grassroots but are actually mask themselves behind a corporate agenda. And so we've got a very powerful influence industry in Washington, and it's surprising. Despite all of the money that they have spent, they have not been very effective, because if you look at Democratic voters and Republican voters outside of the Beltway, there is a strong support for net neutrality. So opposition to net neutrality.
Do people know what it is? Do you find that most Americans even know what net neutrality is? Do half know what it is?
You know, it's a wonky term that nobody would have chosen, you know, to build a political movement around, but it's sort of taken on a life of its own. People have gone on YouTube and done YouTube videos explaining net neutrality.
So you think half of Americans know what it is? I mean, I don't know if they've done any polls on this.
I would guess probably not.
Not half,
although
but
that
maybe,
number is
maybe a third.
As it gets a more prominent play, both in social media and in traditional media.
So I'm wondering whether consumers have any power to choose just as consumers. Part of the problem with these internet providers is there tends to be very little competition. But where there is competition, are there providers that say, if you sign up with us, we promise forevermore to support and protect net neutrality. So maybe we don't go with an AT&T or a Comcast or Verizon. We go with free internet company, which delivers our internet and promises us net neutrality. Is there a way to solve this in the marketplace if there were enough, at least in the places where there's enough competition?
I mean, competition would help a great deal. Unfortunately, we don't have a great deal of competition in the United States, and that you have policies to blame for that, where we favored local monopolies through franchise agreements that allow one cable company to serve one community without competition. So in theory, if you had 9 to 10 choices for high-speed internet, you would have the right as a consumer to choose the one that provides you a connection to the open internet. Unfortunately, more than 75% of people in the United States have two or fewer choices, and those are largely dominant phone and cable companies that are pretty much in lockstep against net neutrality.
Yeah, I have only one choice where I live, and that's Comcast, and I strongly support as much competition as possible. But to me, it's a natural monopoly. It's like water, it's like electricity, and it doesn't seem to me that the water company can turn off someone's tap because they are working for a competitor, or the electricity company can turn off the electricity. Thank you so much, Tim, for being here, for fighting the good fight. I encourage everyone to go to GoFCC yourself and defend your right to the internet. This is Mark Levine. Talk to you on Monday.